Hello, and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. I am the stereotypical professor, and because I am the stereotypical professor, I am rather like the Albert Einstein, who you have all heard of. He is very famous. He wasn't actually a German, of course, he was from Switzerland, but even so, people always think of him when they think of the stereotypical professor, and therefore the stereotypical professor is a German. And today I would like to talk to you about a myth surrounding Albert Einstein and how these kinds of myths have come about. I would like to talk to you about the psychology of exaggeration and the psychology of gossip, and particularly as it relates to Albert Einstein. So hello, and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. So yes, today I would like to talk to you about a very interesting discovery I've made. I think it's an interesting discovery with regard to Albert Einstein and what this tells us about the social psychology of gossip and the social psychology of exaggeration, of where gossip and exaggeration come from. Now, what it's based on is this. In my book, it's based on these rumors that you get about very famous people, this gossip that you get about very famous people, and in particular, this gossip that you get about geniuses. Now, what is the genius? Well, we've discussed on here before. The genius tends to combine very high, outlier high IQ with moderately antisocial personality traits. That is to say, moderately low agreeableness and moderately low conscientiousness. That is impulse control. Now, this helps them to be a genius, because what does a genius involve? It involves coming up with a fantastically original, groundbreaking idea. This will always offend against vested interests, and therefore most people will avoid coming up with a groundbreaking, brilliant idea because it will offend against vested interests and it will get them into trouble. The genius being moderately low in agreeableness, moderately low in altruism, moderately low in empathy, he either doesn't care about that. Or because he just cares about the truth, or because he's so moderately autistic, basically, he wouldn't be able to conceive it would cause offence even if he did care. And secondly, the genius has to think outside the box. He has to think in an original way. And that involves breaking the rules. That involves not being rule-bound. And conscientiousness, this personality trait, is basically impulse control, involves being rule-bound and following the rules and doing everything according to the rules and according to the book. The genius doesn't do that. The genius breaks the rules. And that's why these two key traits, low agreeableness and low conscientiousness, when combined with outlier high intelligence, seem to predict genius. Now, an idea about the genius is that as you become more intelligent, as your IQ goes up, as you get stratospherically high IQ, then what happens is that the relationship between the different components of intelligence, verbal intelligence, linguistic, spatial intelligence, mathematical intelligence, become weaker. As the general intelligence that underpins these gets higher, the positive manifold between the different components of intelligence becomes weaker. Now, intelligence is a bit like a pyramid, you see, and so at the very foot of the pyramid, you have things which are very weak. Associated with intelligence, specialized abilities, the ability to drive a car or do up your shoes or wayfind or whatever. And then these move up to things which are the three big forms of intelligence, which are more strongly correlated with G, such as i.e. verbal intelligence, spatial intelligence, mathematical intelligence, and then these go up to general intelligence. Now, what this means is that when you have stratospherically high intelligence, it is possible to have a very strong intelligence tilt, i.e. to be brilliant at mathematics, which is very highly G loaded and thus have very high general intelligence, but actually not be very linguistically skilled. And from there, you get the typical kind of stereotype of the tongue-tied physicist. Now, taken to its extremes, of course, you can have very high G and be brilliant at things like mathematics, but actually extremely poor, not even not very good, but below average, like worse than the average person at these specialized abilities because of the way in which intelligence is tilted. And so these specialized abilities are things like being able to drive a car or whatever, being able to do your shoelaces up, being able to throw a ball. And from there you get the stereotype of the sort of Sheldon Cooper type of the clever silly, and the clever silly can. Like Sheldon Cooper, he's absolutely brilliant, but he relies on them to drive him to work and all this sort of thing, and he can't do basic things. Things that are basic and ordinary people can do are beyond him. I mean, that's where that comes from. This is the nature of intelligence, that this can happen at very extreme levels of intelligence. A person has very high overall intelligence can be very poor at things an average person is reasonably good at. And now from here, now this was something that was stereotyped to be true. This was something that was believed to be true about many geniuses, and in particular about Einstein. And one of the things that was supposedly true of Einstein was that he would get lost. So he's this extremely brilliant man, this amazing man, this extraordinarily intelligent guy. but he would be rubbish at certain things at the base of the intelligence pyramid. So it was consistent with the kind of nutty professor stereotype, the disorganized professor stereotype, the clever, silly, the very, very intelligent person who can't do ordinary, everyday things. And there's a certain degree to which this stereotype is perhaps rather satisfying to people. Well, firstly, because it makes sense of things. I mean, we observe in our everyday lives the stereotype of this nutty professor who can't do ordinary things, is incompetent at ordinary things, and is highly intelligent. And there's a degree to which this kind of brings this together. But secondly, perhaps it's kind of rather satisfying to ordinary people. To see these brilliant people and think, you might feel a bit of a sort of tinge of jealousy and low self-esteem that, oh, I wish I was as brilliant as them. But on the other hand, you can take pride in the fact that these brilliant people can't do these ordinary things. They're incompetent at ordinary things like relationships and cooking and whatever. And therefore, as a rather average person, this could kind of make you feel a bit better than, well, at least I can do those things. You know, we're all good at our own different things and so on. And so consequently, you can see that there'd be something rather satisfying about this stereotype being true, and indeed about the stereotype being, well, look at it in a minute, about being black and white in its truth, about being very true. Now, one of the things that I heard about Einstein, and I quoted this in my book, At Our Wit's End, Why We're Becoming Less Intelligent and What It Means for the Future, is that apparently he was so good at getting lost that one day he walked into a shop in Princeton, New Jersey, where he lived, and said, "Hi, I'm Einstein, can you take me home?" Now, having done some research recently into this idea that lots and lots of geniuses were born prematurely, having actually gone back to the primary sources and having found that's not the case, even though you've got all these books that will say that Isaac Newton was born, I did a video on it myself, all these books that say Isaac Newton was born prematurely or whatever, it's not, if you go back to the primary sources, it's simply, or Darwin was, if you go back to the primary sources, it's simply not true. So I thought I should go back to the primary sources with this idea. Did Einstein walk into a shop in New Jersey and say, "Oh, hi, I'm Einstein. Can you take me home, please?" It's a wonderful idea, isn't it? Because it's so emblematic of this highly intelligent person who can't cope with normal everyday things. It's so emblematic of the nutty professor stereotype of the law of diminishing returns in terms of intelligence, whereby the very, very highly intelligent people are rubbish at things at the base of the intelligence pyramid that are weakly G-loaded. So I started to trace this. Where had this come from? And I found that somebody in a book called Waves Within had already summarized, without attribution, my own writing on this. So this idea is spreading. Where had this come from? Well, it had been first of all published in The Genius Famine by myself and Bruce Charlton. We stated it there, this anecdote about Einstein. So where did that come from? Well, that seemed to come from Bruce Charlton's blog, in which he had published in about in late November 2014. Again, I'm not sure he attributed it to anybody, but that's what he'd done. So where did that come from? I traced that back. There was an interview in the Daily Telegraph, with my colleague Michael Woodley of Manee on the 14th of November 2014, in which he stated this exact anecdote that Einstein had walked into a shop and said, "Hi, I'm in New Jersey," and said, "Hi, I'm Einstein. Can you take me home, please?" So that, and I kept looking for it, and I couldn't find anything else. That was where it came from. Now, therefore, my colleague started this. I could find no further evidence of this anecdote. Now, I asked him, my colleague, last night, "Well, where did you hear this?" And he said that, well, somebody when he was at university or something had told him this. He couldn't remember exactly who it was, but somebody had told him this and in that form. And he also told me that when he was interviewed by the Daily Telegraph, he said to them, he told them that anecdote, and then he said, "Well, it's probably bullshit." And that, of course, wasn't quoted in the article. They simply quoted the anecdote. We'll look at why in a minute. But they simply quoted the juicy anecdote without the qualification that it's probably bullshit. So I looked into it, and then I started to realise that the person that had told my colleague this, it must have slowly become exaggerated and embellished from an earlier anecdote. And this was the idea that Einstein had, that Princeton University had received a telephone call one day from someone who said, "Hello, can I have the address and directions from here to the home address of Albert Einstein, please?" And they said, "I'm sorry, we can't give this information out. This is confidential." And then he said, "But I am Albert Einstein." So that was that anecdote that my colleague had heard had been embellished from an earlier anecdote, which was rather different, which was that he telephoned the university and asked them for his own address and directions to his own address because he got lost. This I traced back from various people that had quoted it, such as Uncle John's Bathroom Reader Plunges into New Jersey. He had cited an article online by John Blackwell of the Trentonian, This was that he called the Dean's office and said, could he have directions to Einstein's house? And this I managed to trace back even further. This wasn't dated, but this had been cited as early as 2003. And this I managed to trace back even further to an opinion piece in the New York Times entitled New Jersey Opinion, The Day Einstein Went Public by Tom Mackin, that was published on the 12th of March 1989, in which he wrote about having gone to a conference in 1955. He was a journalist, Tom Mackin. He was an Irish-born journalist. He was born about 1920. He died in 1911. He came to America as an infant. And he was a journalist and TV journalist and pundit and whatever. Sort of gossip columnist, really. And he wrote, it is said, he telephoned the Institute one day to ask the operator if she could direct him to Einstein's home. She said she was not able to give this information, but he said, this is Professor Einstein, and I don't know where I am, I'm lost, he said. So this is where it has come from. And it's been embellished to ringing the Dean's office. You can see how this is being exaggerated. This is what Tom Mackin said. Now, what do we know about Tom Mackin? Well, Tom Mackin, as I said, was a person who was very interested in gossip. In 2009, he published his own book. It was called Brief Encounters from Einstein. Sorry, 2008, Brief Encounters from Einstein to Elvis. And all this was a self-published book about his own interactions with famous people and basically gossip that he'd heard about them. Tittle-tattle. Lovely tidbits of information, fascinating, you know, salacious, whatever, tidbits of information that he'd heard about them presented in the book, including this unsighted thing, which he'd obviously heard somewhere, perhaps in 1955. In 1955, Einstein did a sort of conference thing, basically, a presentation to the media to celebrate his birthday or something like this. And he went to the Princeton Inn on the 14th of March 1955, and did this media thing, and Tom Mackin went to that, and that's where he met Einstein, and presumably where he heard lots of rumours about Einstein from other people, and then this was worked in to this gossipy book about various celebrities that he'd met or had contact with or whatever, or interviewed during his time working as a journalist, which he wrote when he was an elderly man, when he was in his 80s. So therefore I trace it back, and that is the origin of the information. Now, I would say that is not a very good source, is it? Obviously, this is a journalist. This is a kind of journalist that is prepared to write gossipy books, gossipy tell-all books about my time with various celebrities. And how would you do that? Well, obviously, you would exaggerate, you would embellish, you would be interested in making a good story. If it had been a scientist that was the ultimate source of this claim, if it had been someone that knew Einstein personally that was the ultimate source of this claim, then we might give it some credibility. But the fact that it is merely a journalist that likes gossip and likes writing these sort of gossipy, salacious books which present tittle-tattle and sort of interesting information to arouse the reader's curiosity, makes one think that the claim itself may well be exaggerated. And anyway, it's whatever the guy's heard, whatever Tom Mackin has heard, he's just heard it. And so presumably by some process of Chinese whispers, whatever happened may have been exaggerated. And all it will probably get back to is that at some point, perhaps, Einstein got lost. And that's it. Well, we've all got lost, perhaps, or certainly I yeah. So basically, the reasonable conclusion from the historical perspective is that this never happened. And this rumour about Einstein is simply untrue. So where does it come from? What is the psychology of gossip? Why do we have this? Why does this happen? Well, if we look at it from an evolutionary perspective, we are a highly social species. We are a eusocial species, and we interact strongly with each other, we invest strongly with each other, and therefore we need to know information about other people. Under conditions of Darwinian selection, people that were interested in gossip, that were interested in knowing information about other people, would accrue that information about other people and would therefore be at an advantage in interacting with other people. And consequently, there would have been a selection pressure for people to want to be interested in gossip. And those who weren't interested in gossip and finding out lots of information about other people would have been less likely to pass on their genes. So you can see how we would be selected to be interested in gossip. Why is it, though, that we are prepared to believe this information, which is, you know, inaccurate, which information that can be traced back and can be found to be exaggerated or inaccurate? How does that work? Why would we be evolved to be gullible to a certain degree to inaccurate information? Well, it seems to me there are two key reasons for this. One is that we are a people, there's computer models and whatever have shown that people that a group that is internally cooperative is more likely to survive under evolutionary conditions than a group that is untrusting. And therefore, trust is a huge part of a eusocial species. We have to be able to trust people. Not too much. If you trust people too much, then you're gullible and you can be manipulated and taken advantage of, and you won't pass on your genes. But if you don't trust people enough, then you won't be able to create strong bonds with people, and you won't be able to get on with people and have friends and relationships, and you won't be able to pass on your genes. And so gullibility can be being sucked in by something which is untrue, or is, oh, I'm not sure about that. It can be seen as a flip side of the importance of trust in evolution. Also, there could be a degree to which this is a matter of openness, being those that were open-minded to the possibility that something rather sort of bizarre and unbelievable about something was true, even though it might not have, may have been at an advantage compared to those that weren't open-minded about these kinds of things. We can see it in terms of a sort of smoke detector principle. If you say to somebody, there is no advantage to not believing something that is quite bad about somebody that is not true, because then you'll avoid that bad person, and then you know you will get on better and you won't get killed. And so consequently, it aids on the side of paranoia, on the side of caution, and therefore you would expect people to believe bad things about people more than perhaps they should. Simply because those in prehistory that were more inclined, more open to believing bad things about people would therefore avoid bad people and would be less likely to be killed, would be more likely to survive, more likely to pass on their genes. And so you can see how we would be open to believing exaggerations, only slight exaggerations, of course. I mean, if it's too bizarre an exaggeration, then you're gullible and that would be associated with being taken in by people, manipulated by people, conned by people, and you wouldn't pass on your genes. But we would be some sort of selection to being open to moderate exaggerations of the truth for the reason outlined. Now, the second question is, why do we gossip? We've understood why it is that we are prone to be interested in gossip. Why do we gossip? Well, in a social species, if you can, we want information about people. It's adaptive. It's adaptive to have new and interesting information about people. And so obviously, if you can provide information about people, if you can be a gossip, if you can provide information about people, then other people will like you. Other people will want to be your friend. You will be socially selected for. You may even be sexually selected for as a consequence of being a gossip. And consequently, your genes will be more likely to be passed on because people will want to be around you. People will like you. You will be a source of information. You will be useful to them. People will want to be your friend. Now, the question is, obviously, if you're too much of a gossip, if people come to the conclusion that they can't trust you and whatever, well, then that's going to be a bad thing. People will reject you. People will shun you. People won't tell you things. But if you're too little of a gossip, then you won't compete. There will be a competition in a sort of an arms race to gossip, essentially. There will be competition to get friends, competition to get partners, and gossip and the ability to provide new and interesting gossip will be a means by which you can win that competition. If you don't engage in it enough, then you will just be outcompeted and you will pass on fewer of your genes. If you are too extreme in it, i.e. if you come up with gossip that's obviously insane and very unlikely, or if you break people's confidences in a very obvious and over-the-top way and you're found out, well, then that's no good either. And so therefore, an equilibrium of being a bit of a gossip, of being a little bit prone to gossiping, is going to be maintained within the population. And that seems to have been what's happened. Now, how is it that exaggeration works? Why is it that things become exaggerated over time? This is very interesting. If you look back in history, I mean, it always seems to happen. You have this process of exaggeration. And you see this with the Einstein thing. There was something that happened, probably. Probably he got a bit lost somewhere. And this has been embellished and embellished. First of all, it becomes ringing the Institute. Then it becomes ringing the Dean's office. Then it becomes probably other things that I haven't heard. All the way up to walking into a shop which that starts to become very unlikely, and saying, "Hi, I'm Einstein, can you take me home?" Which again doesn't seem particularly credible, but it's just about within the realms of possibility. It's just about believable. So where does this process of exaggeration come from? Well, obviously, if you're gossiping, then the way that you can be regarded as a useful gossip and get yourself liked is to come up with something new. Come up with something new and interesting, some fascinating, insightful, titillating nugget of information. Well, how do you do that? How do you make sure that you're competing in the gossip hierarchy? Well, you exaggerate it very, very slightly, and that's it. And so you tell somebody, and then that person will exaggerate it very, very slightly. And because the exaggeration is only very slight, it's believable. And perhaps even the person that does the exaggerating doesn't even regard themselves as lying. And there's been some interesting studies on this. People, for example, will exaggerate their own test scores. Always people will exaggerate their test scores. They will exaggerate things about themselves. And when they do tests on them, and they find that those people do not react as though they are lying. They do not become less relaxed when they tell these lies. They become more relaxed when they tell these lies. Because these lies are a way of kind of boosting their self-esteem. These lies are a manifestation of their own ambitions rather than an assertion of the truth. And in the same way, when people say, "Oh, you've never ever helped me in an argument," and of course that's an exaggeration, but it's a way of emotionally manipulating the person, and it's a way of engaging in social intercourse successfully. And consequently, those people will not regard themselves as lying. They will regard themselves as telling the truth, which will make the strategy all the more successful, because if you don't believe you are lying, then you will be all the more convincing, and therefore in the case of gossip, you will be all the more convincing a gossip and all the more attractive a gossip. And so therefore there is this tendency, in order to compete, to make sure it's a new, juicy nugget of information, to slightly exaggerate. Not to exaggerate too much, that's no good, then you will be seen as a liar and you won't be, but nobody will like you. But to exaggerate a little bit within the bounds of believability. And it's via that process that things become magnified over time. Einstein is obviously an example. Another example is a book that I've written, Churchill's Headmaster, the Sadist and the State of the British Empire, in which I look at his prep school headmaster, Herbert Snape Kinnersley. He is portrayed in certain books as basically a sexual pervert who took pleasure out of beating children until they excreted, and then took further sexual pleasure out of cleaning their excreta off the walls of his study. That is what is stated in a book about Winston Churchill. And you trace this back, and you get back to the primary sources, and you find that the degree of exaggeration that has taken place with regard to Snape Kinnersley since about 1930, when he was first written about, is quite extraordinary. It's quite extraordinary, and the reality is very, very different, and that he was probably less severe than a lot of prep school headmasters in his beatings of the time, of the 1880s. So this is how this process can occur, and you can see the sort of evolution, why it is adaptive for it to occur. And the second dimension of why it occurs is that we like a fixed reality. It makes us feel good to have a world in which everything makes sense. And this will tend us towards exaggeration and confirmation bias. We don't want to be in an ambiguous situation where Einstein doesn't quite fit into previously existing stereotypes about the nature of the nutty professor. We want him to be, either he is a genius, in which case he is the nutty professor stereotype, or he isn't a genius, in which case he isn't the nutty professor stereotype. And so therefore, in order for reality to make sense, and it makes us feel secure, we as animals, we like a reality that makes sense, that's clear and black and white, there is a tendency to exaggerate things in order to ensure that he is definitely either X or Y. And in this case, you can see how you would exaggerate the degree to which he might get lost or be otherwise socially incompetent or whatever, in order to ensure that he fits into this nice, neat stereotype. And then the other thing, of course, is that you get confirmation bias. Once you get these stereotypes about people, you will get people looking for further evidence of, let's say, Einstein getting lost or Einstein doing something which implies he's a nutty professor, and they won't look for evidence of the opposite, for evidence that he was a rather more rounded human being. They will ignore and play down evidence that this is not the case, so that they can have a nice, neat reality in which everything makes sense. And so this is where these things come from, and it's why history is so fascinating, because over time, it's why history is so interesting to dig back into the primary sources, because what you will tend to find is that the reality, I'm afraid, is rather less interesting than and rather less black and white than it ends up being many years later. So my conclusion is that idea that Einstein walked into a shop in New Jersey and said, "Hi, I'm Einstein, can you take me home?" which is just about within the Einstein believability criteria. And even the idea it's based on, which is that he got lost and rang up his university and said, "Can you give me Einstein's address? We can't give you his address now, Einstein." That never happened. Okay, I hope this is a bit of interest, and if it has, then you can see ways of, please, of course, subscribe, please spread the word, please follow me on Twitter, at Jolly Heretic. We are live on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 o'clock UK time, 2 o'clock New York time. I was live streaming on here. If you want to support the channel, you can see ways to do so below, and I will see you soon, and goodbye.